You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Christine Buckley, and this is Field Talk, a podcast in which we explore the work of authors whose papers have been published in three of the Society's journals, Ecology, Ecological Applications, and Ecological Monographs. Today I'm speaking with James Hudson, whose work on plant biomass in the high Arctic was published in the October issue of Ecology. The paper is based on Hudson's graduate work at the University of British Columbia, where he studied a heath community in the high Arctic. He and his colleagues found that over time, warming trends in this area have led to an increase in plant productivity. James, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Christine.
So first of all, it sounds like your study site is pretty unique. Can you describe what it's like there and a little bit about its history?
Sure. I did my work at the beautiful Alexander Fjord, which is on the east central coast of Ellesmere Island, which is Canada's northernmost island. And if you are to look at where it would be on a map or on a globe, it's at about the same latitude as the Svalbard archipelago in Norway. So it's pretty far north. On one side of our site, we have a beautiful fjord. On two sides, we've got steep cliffs and mountains. And on the other side, we have a series of glaciers. The site itself has some very interesting history as well. The region was used over 1,000 years ago by the precursor to the Inuit people, which we refer to as the Thule people. More recently, explorers that were going for the pole were using the area as a stopover. And even more recently than that, in the 1950s and 60s, the police force in Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, set up an outpost here that we now use the buildings from.
And how big is the site approximately?
Well, if you look at it from an aerial map, it's about 8 square kilometers of vegetated lowland. So it's near the ocean, down near about sea level.
And this area that you worked in is a tundra, right?
Exactly. The big thing to think about when you think of tundra is that there are no trees. There are lots of shrubs, though, but they're not the shrubs that you and I think about that we'd have in our gardens or on our lawns. They're really short shrubs, and what you'd want to think of them as if they're climbing plants. And climbing plants, some are the ones that you see in your garden that you put up on a vine, but instead of climbing vertically, they climb along the ground.
Interesting. In your study, you looked at the productivity of these tundra shrubs and other plants. Can you explain to us what productivity means in vegetation in general?
Sure. Tundra productivity refers to how much the plants are growing in any given year, or how much they've grown since they were first beginning to be plants. So in this study, we looked at both, how much they're growing just in the short growing season that is for the Arctic, or how much they're growing since we began measuring them.
And one might think that plants in this high Arctic tundra would be relatively unproductive. Is that the case?
In many ways, it is true. So the plants that are there are both short and small. And you have to think, in the Arctic, it's actually advantageous if you're a plant to be short and small. Mm-hmm. And the reasons for that is that because it's much warmer and you're much closer to the ground, which is very warm, relative to the air. You're also protected against things like the cold winds. So most plants are that live in the Arctic are what we'd consider to be Arctic specialists. They have many unique adaptations for dealing with life in the cold. What surprised us in this study was that the plants that we expected to be resistant and to tolerate the cold conditions the most are actually responding to the warmer conditions that have happened over the last few decades.
And what are those changing conditions? Have you seen an appreciable increase in temperatures?
That's the primary response that we've been seeing in terms of the climate. We saw about a 2.5 degrees Celsius spike in temperature over the last few decades, but mm-hmm. we're also seeing other corresponding changes. Temperatures can also cause changes like growing season length. They can lengthen the growing season, or they can also deepen the permafrost layer, the top layer which seasonally melts, that melts every year. It's called the active layer. And what we've noticed at our site is that that's been increasing over the last several decades.
Right. And did you also measure biodiversity here, too, and look at what different species are in each of these quadrants?
Exactly. Whenever we're counting whatever species are in these plots, we can take a lot of other measurements at the same time. And one of them, you're right, is biodiversity. So we wanted to see which species were there, how much of them. And we were also looking at height. We're trying to see if the plants are getting taller or shorter, and what we found is that they're actually getting significantly taller. The plants have doubled in height. A doubling of the height is a big deal.
That's pretty amazing. You also mentioned, I think in your paper, that there was a little bit of change in the abundance of some species. Were these the shrubs that you looked at, or other types of...
Yeah, that's a very good point, Christine, is that the changes that we saw in certain species in certain groups weren't the ones that we were predicting. We expected the species that would be most tolerant, the species that are coming in from the south, the species that are used to more favorable conditions, would be the ones to grow larger and to get more dense as the conditions became more favorable. But what we actually saw was that it was the species that many people have predicted not to have increased as much. And so that was surprising to us. And those groups were the evergreen shrubs and the mosses.
Can you look at this kind of difference in this area and predict what would happen at a similar area that you haven't studied yet?
It's a good point. And that's one of the issues that researchers that work at this local level struggle with. And the way we try and get around it is with multiple studies at different sites. And what we try and do is form networks with researchers that are doing similar work to us and develop standardized protocols. And what we end up doing is collecting data and synthesizing data from multiple sites around the Arctic to get that better picture, because we don't work at the same scale as satellite observations.
Mm-hmm.
So what we try and get is a snapshot from many different places across the Arctic, and together patch that into pieces in a puzzle.
And these kinds of studies are really important, too, because there's been a flurry of data in recent years that say that the Arctic is pretty important for global biogeochemical cycling. So how do you think that the differences in productivity in the tundra that you study or in other tundras will influence these global chemical cyclings?
It's a great point. It's one of the first things that we've looked for when doing these productivity studies, is what are the effects on global geochemical cycles. Now, the challenge has been the very simple answer, which is the one that increased productivity should increase the ability of these ecosystems to retain carbon, is a lot more complex than we actually first gave it credit. And so a lot of work in the Arctic is currently going towards understanding the relationship between carbon flux, that is, whether the carbon is going in and or out of these ecosystems, and how
right.
the plants are actually growing. So at our site, we have some work currently being done by a researcher at the University of Saskatchewan named Steve Siciliano, who's looking at that exact question.
Now, you said earlier that you learned from some people in the area that they've been noticing changes in the vegetation in the area. So have you yourself noticed any of these over the relatively short time that you've been working up there?
We've been very fortunate in that my supervisor, Dr. Greg Henry, has been going up to the site since about 1980. And so he has a 30-year memory of what the site looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's been able to do is that he had the foresight to monitor a lot of very simple metrics, things that anybody could do if they were to go up and to be a scientist for a day. Things like, where is the toe of the glacier? Or when is the first time we get bit by a mosquito?
Mm-hmm.
Or when does the ocean become ice-free? And these simple metrics, when measured over a long period of time, give you a very good indication that many aspects of the climate are changing in this ecosystem. I can't say that I've seen changes over the last 2 or 3 years. They're mostly the changes that the data is telling me, and that now I get to see with my own eyes the changes in relative numbers of birds or of seals or of biting insects like mosquitoes.
So are you getting bitten more or earlier in the season now by mosquitoes?
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when I asked my supervisor about the research site when I was first contemplating doing my graduate work with him, he told me that you never, ever get bit by mosquitoes. you're just too far north. And the mosquito season is very brief, and you don't have to ever bring bug spray or a bug hat.
This is probably one of the reasons why you decided to work with them, huh?
Well, that's exactly. It's one of the few spots in the Arctic isn't run over with bugs yet. But in the last couple of years, the bug season has gotten longer and much more intense.
Oh, no. You get bit by a lot of mosquitoes, but there must be some really wonderful perks to working up there. You mentioned how beautiful it is. But then also there are the trials of field work. How do you physically get up there, and do you stay for many days or weeks at a time when you get there?
Yeah, it's a great question. When we decide to do a field season, our logistical planning has to begin the year before, because most of our supplies are shipped up by ship, and those ships leave in July of the previous year.
Oh, wow.
And so you need to decide how much food you need and what sort of equipment you want brought up 1 year prior to actually going up there.
Wow.
The other sort of logistical challenges are associated with getting the right amount of food and getting the equipment you need, because you just don't have the opportunity to go to the corner store to get those things.
How far is it to the closest place where you could purchase something?
Well, that's a good question, and it's somewhat relative in the sense that if we were to fly from our site down to the community of Resolute Bay, which is the second northernmost community in Canada, and that's our hub for traveling to and from, that's about a 2.5 hour flight.
When you go into the field, how long do you stay?
Because it is so expensive to go up there, we make sure we get our money's worth. And so we try and go in before the snow melts. And the snow usually melts sometime in June. So we're there right after the end of the spring semester at school. So sometime in late May usually. And then we stay until the end of August. Mm-hmm. So we're there essentially from spring to fall. Like when we come in, there's still snow on the ground. And when we leave, there's often snow on the ground.
Wow. What does the future hold for the work that's going on at this site?
That's a very good question. The work that's done is primarily done under the auspices of the International Tundra Experiment, mm-hmm. a group that my supervisor Greg Henry has led for the last few years. And what they're looking at now is the evolutionary adaptations to climate change of these plants. We've been monitoring them and seeing that they've been changing in terms of their size, their growth, when they're flowering. The morphological or the physical characteristics are changing. But now we want to see what sort of impact that has in terms of evolutionary adaptations. Are they actually responding at the genetic level?
Mm-hmm. It's really amazing to hear you talk about this. It seems like such a retreat kind of experience. And of course, you're working hard while you're there. But what do you think is your favorite part of doing this research in such a remote, beautiful place?
I think that it is that you recharge your batteries. And many people have the same sort of interest in returning to or going to the north, in that it's such a beautiful place. It has so many great questions to answer. It's such a simple system from an ecological perspective. And the people that you get to work with are so fantastic that it makes you want to go back year after year.
Like a drug almost.
Exactly.
James, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Christine.
That was James Hudson, a former master's student at the University of British Columbia, talking about his work in the October issue of Ecology. I'm Christine Buckley. Thanks for listening to Field Talk.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Catelli. For a link to Dr. Catelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.